So there's a reason we do the job we do, and it's not people that don't have the knowledge and training that we have, right? Thunder Bay is a prime example of why we should attend the scenes, but they've made it almost impossible to do that.
Yeah. I keep saying it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. I wish I could figure out it better, but you know, they make it so bad, so we lose corners, and then they have to hire nurses, and it's a vicious circle.
Yep.
Can't attract people. Don't make it more lucrative or more interesting to get involved in.
I asked them what they thought about the closure of the Thunder Bay Forensics Facility.
Our transportation costs are now going to be the most expensive part of the death investigation system, by far. And it's unnecessary, and it's a waste of money. Why should a family in Thunder Bay have to wait 2 weeks to get the body back for funeral arrangements? It's lip service, right? It's lipstick on a pig.
So why are all these changes happening? Have they been at the direction of the chief coroner, Dirk Hoyer? Kubarevic said that Hoyer might just be following orders from the province.
He was my regional supervising coroner one time, and I love the guy. I don't know what happened. I do think that he's stuck in a very tough situation of having to be political, not just as a, you know, being a physician and protecting the system as we might see fit as physicians. I think he has to do what the politicians are forcing on him.
One thing I was curious about was how the various roles involved in death investigations work together, like forensics, police, coroners. By the time the coroner comes in, if they are called at all, any number of things can happen. And what if one of those systems is failing? What if they all are?
I'm just thinking how really we are a parallel investigation system. We're not here supposedly to lay blame, but a lot of what we then have to rely on, we don't have the resources to do a police investigation. We have to rely on the police to do it. If they tell us, oh yes, we found all this evidence of this being a suicide, it's very difficult to say, well, no, you're lying to us.
And that gets tricky when a police service has been found by a provincial watchdog to be systemically racist, like with the Thunder Bay Police.
So if you have a racist police force, as my understanding is Thunder Bay has been shown to be, that's problematic, and that's why you need coroners at scenes, because that is part of our job, is oversight into these types of things, right? We're the ones that call out when things are not being done properly. We're the ones shining that light onto that.
Meanwhile, we'd hit the jackpot on the FOI request to get to the bottom of why the Thunder Bay Forensics Lab was shut down.
We filed 4 Freedom of Information requests. 3 hit dead ends. After 90 days, the last one came in. It was worth the wait.
Yeah, so what was in it?
The first thing we uncovered is how Ontario's pathology lead, Dr. Michael Polanin, was leading the discussion on the creation of full post-mortem lab in Thunder Bay since 2017. That's a year before anyone formally recommended it.
That's weird. I remember you saying that there was only a small unit in the hospital that handled post-mortem services.
Yes, so this would be a new complex, much, much better facility.
Right. So what happened?
Everything slammed to a halt 4 months before the 2018 election. Polanin says the government's in caretaking mode, and there's nothing that can be done until a new government comes in. The PCs were elected in June, and then the tracks just kind of end on the whole conversation.
So that leaves Thunder Bay with just the hospital facility, which they already said wasn't enough.
We can see through these documents that Thunder Bay's hospital felt it was in crisis. The leadership, all the way up to Polanin, was worried that the grieving family members would take the service failures to the media and the pressure that that would put on the system. So leaving it the way it was became plan A.
Their plan then was to do nothing.
Their plan was to let it rot on the vine. We can see here that in 2021, Ontario offered the hospital only $50,000 to run this service for all of Northwestern Ontario. That's about $400 a body, and it hasn't seen an increase since 2007. And shipping each body to Toronto and back, this is shipping costs alone now, costs $6,000. So 6,000 times 262 bodies last year, we spent more than 1.5 million, 30 times more than Ontario was prepared to pay to keep services open in Thunder Bay.
Jesus Christ.
On the hospital's letterhead, you can see this here, we have senior management saying they can't do this for $400 a body. As far as they're concerned, Ontario can keep their money.
It just doesn't make any sense. Like, why would they do that?
It was clearly about the money. The hospital says these services, quote, put tremendous pressure on staff, capacity, and resources at a time when the healthcare system is under immense pressure and will be for the foreseeable future. But Ryan, it's equally clear that they knew that this was going to look really bad. In emails, Polainen is concerned about responding to media inquiries and public pressure. Dr. Polainen sums it up like this, quote, my own view is that we cannot be perceived to be wholly withholding services to the community, particularly Indigenous families who already have a disproportionate set of conditions against them at the time of an untimely death.
So what you're saying is that the chief forensic pathologist for Ontario appears to have known about the need to make death investigations better for Indigenous families and agrees there should be a new facility in the Northwest, and then just suddenly the plan is off and he's worried about how it all looks instead.
Well, it's exactly what it looks like. It's service cuts in how Ontario investigates death. Even in Thunder Bay, where the racist dysfunction in the system is infamous. Like, where are we supposed to go from here?
Coming up next week on episode 2 of Thunder Bay Postmortem.
Everyone failed him. The coroner, the hospital, and the police.
There are families waiting for this information.
It became full-blown fury at the fact that this was being allowed to happen yet again.
Where does that all go? You know, you're making it for nothing if the people that are closest to these people that are passing aren't finding the closure.
That is your Canada Land. Please join us next week for part 2 of Thunder Bay Postmortem. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything that you send. We're on Twitter at Canada Land. Our website is canadaland.com. This episode was reported by Ryan McMahon, John Thompson, and Cherie Suturin. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Additional production and editing from Tristan Capicchione. Our managing editor is Annette Ejofor. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So Called. Additional music by Chris Dirksen. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. Glenn McGregor, reporter in the Parliamentary Press Gallery in Ottawa, formerly of the Ottawa Citizen and CTV, currently writing an excellent Substack everybody should check out.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing okay. Glenn, today on our show, a Liberal Party plot against Justin Trudeau. Welcome to Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news. Okay. Okay, so Glenn, I've just been seeing headline after headline, starting off with stuff that just seemed like regular news reporting. Trudeau's situation in the polls is terrible, and of course the press is going to report on that, so we get the usual headlines about his flagging leadership. But, you know, it's still tempered. As of, you know, early mid-October, Canada's Trudeau, far behind in polls, remains the Liberals' best chance. That was by Stephen Scherer. But it starts to turn at a certain point. Frustrated Liberals say Pierre Poilievre is crushing them, and some of them are blaming Justin Trudeau. Complaints from within the Liberal Party. Here's Lawrence Martin in The Globe. Why doesn't Justin Trudeau understand that Canadians want change? Why doesn't he understand? And then a senator, Trudeau resignation, prudent course of action, says senator from PEI. Huh. Then Susan Delacourt from the Toronto Star, who my opinion of her work is that since Justin Trudeau has been prime minister, anytime he's been in trouble, he's had Susan Delacourt there to say, here's why Justin's actually right, and I've got the inside scoop. I've got people close to him telling me what really happened, and it's not so bad. When you lose Susan Delacourt, here's Susan Delacourt. Justin Trudeau is a problem for his party, and even if he quits, it might not save the Liberals, polls suggest. And then all of these headlines bring up the question, well, if it's not Trudeau, who's it going to be? All of a sudden, this is November 2nd, Marika Walsh, senior political reporter for the Globe and Mail. Mark Carney, former head of the Bank of Canada. Mark Carney says he hasn't ruled out Liberal leadership run. It's weird that that's news. I also haven't ruled it out, Glenn, but I'm not in the Globe and Mail.
Neither am I, and I'm out of a job, so yeah.
What's going on here? I think I know how to read news stories, but sometimes I think that maybe there's a story in between the stories or behind it. Why are we suddenly hearing all this?
I think a part of the reason is that, as you know, the parliamentary press gallery that covers the prime minister is kind of a pack animal. It hunts as a pack. And when it turns on something, it all goes together. And I think you're seeing that happening a little bit now. It kind of puts me in mind of those old sort of Mutual of Omaha videos where you had like the, you know, the injured wildebeest that got separated from its herd on the Serengeti, and then the pride of lions sees weakness and kind of descend. Now, there have been columnists who have been writing the same column about Justin Trudeau about to leave for years, and they do them regularly, probably quarterly. There's some conservative columnists who write that over and over and over again. And like a stop clock, it's going to be true at some point, right? But this is probably different because you do have such unhappiness among voters, although I'm not sure that is transferring over to the party caucus or Liberal Party membership writ large. Percy Down, the senator you referred to, used to be the chief of staff to Jean Chrétien. He was the first one to come out and say it's time for him to go. Keep in mind, though, that Percy Down is not a Liberal senator. He was a Liberal senator, and then Justin Trudeau kicked them all out of the party caucus back in before he became prime minister. So there's a little bit of bad blood there between some Liberals who were in the Senate who now have to sit as independent or members of these different various Senate factions. So what we haven't seen are members of the Liberal caucus coming out publicly saying it's time for a change or aligning themselves publicly with another potential candidate. And there's a rubric for this. We've seen this happen before, the Paul Martin period when Jean Chrétien was still prime minister, and there was open dissension within the caucus, and you saw people, MPs who were loyal to Paul Martin, who was then the finance minister and then moved out, aligning with him, publicly speaking about him. And eventually it was a coup d'etat. I mean, the Martin people successfully toppled Chrétien and he was gone. I don't see anything like that happening right now because you don't have a really strong candidate who was going to challenge Trudeau. And I mean, I think ultimately, if you look back at this, you've got all these opposition parties and their supporters calling for Trudeau to leave. Say, it's time for him to go. It's time for him to go. You have a lot of conservative media saying, he's got to go. He's got to go. Well, why is that? If he was so weakened and so unlikely to win another election, you would think that they would want him to stay. They think they would want to run against him. And I think the reason for this is they know that he is still probably the best shot the Liberals have, maybe not of winning government again, but stemming the losses a bit, right? So if the polls, the numbers we're seeing now hold, and we have this Pierre Poilievre juggernaut taking us into the next election campaign, the Liberals are going to want to preserve as much, save as much as the furniture, as the expression goes. And I think a lot of them think, you know, even a unpopular Justin Trudeau is better positioned to do that than some of the other names.
So, okay, maybe it's PAC journalism and the PAC smells blood, so they're attacking. But where is the scent of blood coming from? What is a trial balloon in, like, political coverage parlance? What does that mean, a trial balloon?
A trial balloon means something that is floated often anonymously, passed on by a source who isn't identified, about something, a policy change that is being considered.
You want to see how the public's going to respond, so you sort of like leak a rumor about it, or you get people talking about it, and then you're testing the waters. If it's just like shouted down and humiliated, you're like, okay, that's not real. We were never
actually going to do that. Yeah, and journalists get used a lot as the conduit for these. You know, they'll have someone contact a journalist, someone in their staff, and say, I'm going to talk to you on record or off record or on background. One of the things that is being considered, and I can't say we're going to go ahead with this, but, you know, we're going to, for example, we're thinking about taking the carbon tax off home heating oil, for example, to use a current issue. That wasn't really done that much in this instance, and maybe they should have. Maybe they should have floated the trial balloon, see if it would fly, because this didn't. And this is becoming, you know, the latest in a string of missteps and disasters and problems that the prime minister has had, only just the most recent. I mean, this has been a long list. We just go back to January, the things that have been happening that have not helped him politically. The largest part of this, of course, is the context of the economy, the inflation rate, the housing problem. This has all been discussed at length. Interest rates are killing them. And then you've had problems on sort of the international front, the alleged murder of a Sikh activist in British Columbia that Trudeau went out and just all of a sudden blamed on India, you know, like stood up in the House of Commons. It was quite unusual.
We could go on and on. Like, you got me thinking, like, it from, you know, blackface, got a Nazi in Parliament, is just destroying the relationship with India. It just kind of went nowhere, that accusation, all these things. And then it's like, oh, an exemption to the carbon tax? That's going to be the thing?
I don't know if it's going to be the thing. I think it's the latest thing. And like I said, like, this is the way all these news stories are now being interpreted in the context of, does Justin Trudeau have to go? Right? And I think that's the difference now. Back when the blackface affair happened, I mean, that was in the middle of an election campaign in 2019, so it wasn't a question of dumping him at the time. But, you know, all these other micro scandals or crises that the government has faced haven't been sort of interpreted that way, because now the PAC is moved. Everything that happens on Parliament Hill, we're looking to see, is this a sign that he is going to go?
And who is motivating it? Because if you're going to introduce into the public conversation, and, you know, the way the media sometimes works is, you know, you hear this refrain, does he have to go? They say he's got to go. NDP, Liberals, this one, that one. And it just becomes such a repetitive refrain that it's, at a certain point you're like, I guess he's got to go. But then it raises the question, well, who could possibly replace him? And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, here's Mark Carney's name. Was that a trial balloon?
I think Carney has liked to keep his name in the news in this context, and he's been doing it for a long time. I mean, we've been hearing about Mark Carney as possible the great white hope of the Liberal Party for over a decade, at least, going back to the period when the party was having such difficulties with leadership. After Martin, Liberals were voted out of power, then they went through this process where they were trying out different leaders. Bob Rae was the interim leader at one point. Then we got Stéphane Dion, and then eventually Michael Ignatieff. And Carney's name was, you know, being bandied about back then. I don't think Carney's going to do it. And I'll tell you very, you know, very succinctly why. I mean, he's got a great resume, like Michael Ignatieff did, but he's making, I think, a lot of money now. He's the chair of Bloomberg, right? That's a big job. And, he's got positions on corporate boards, these kinds of things. I don't imagine he would want to leave that position. I don't know what that position of Bloomberg pays, because it is a private company. It's not a publicly traded company, so we can't get a lot of insight into their remuneration of executives. But I'm going to guess $5 million US, I think, would be a conservative guess. He's doing fine. Why would you leave that to become leader, potentially to become leader of the opposition, or even potentially, if the polls are to be believed, leader of the third party in the House of Commons, and have to do that for 4 years rebuilding your party? I don't think that's a very attractive option for Mark Carney. It reminds me a little bit of another name that was bandied about as a potential Liberal leadership contender, was Frank McKenna, the former premier of New Brunswick. Everybody thought he was going to be great. He had the business bona fides. He was an experienced politician. He's going to come in. He's going to save everything. He ended up working for a bank and making, you know, even more than what probably Carney's making now. He was making like, you know, at least $10 million, I think, when his bonuses were included. So it's a nice fantasy for people to have. I don't think it's going to happen with Carney. And then that leaves you with, you know, a smaller group of far less attractive candidates who might succeed Trudeau.
Actually, that raises another possible motive for, like, Mark Carney has to want his name to be in the paper for us to be reading that he hasn't ruled it out. It's very easy to not be written about. So my question, why would we be reading about him if he wasn't staging some kind of a trial balloon to see if there's an appetite for this? Well, you could be raising your profile for your actual day job, making yourself a hot commodity in that sense. I mean, anybody could be kind of more attractive in the corporate sector if you're, you know, seriously considered in the political realm.
Yeah, I'm not sure he needs to do that much. I mean, he has been professionally Mark Carney for a while.
So then why do you, why are we, like, you know, why would he do the interview? Why would he let that rumor, you know, that's a decision, right?
Yeah, I mean, I could be completely wrong. Maybe he really wants to do it. I mean, I'm always baffled that people want to get into politics.
Like, if everybody went nuts for this news, or, oh, fantastic, our savior is here. Like, that's what a trial balloon is for. Maybe right. People love it, and then you know. I guess what I'm learning from this is, like, if my conspiratorial thinking, if I'm thinking, like, no, this isn't coming from the press corps, this is coming from the Liberal Party, that might be, like, true, but, like, only maybe to some degree. Like, certain voices who are dissatisfied might be part of that, as opposed to kind of a centralized, let's build a narrative, because the party's going to do worse without him, probably, than with him in this next election, even as they lose.
The other thing to remember is the party was almost, you know, virtually defunct before he came along. I mean, after Ignatieff, it was a disaster, and they had to rebuild it really from the ground up. And most of the MPs who are now in the Liberal caucus were elected because of Justin Trudeau in 2015. They wouldn't have jobs. And they haven't known another leader. Some of them lost their jobs. And, I mean, they lost seats in the last two election campaigns. But, you know, the bulk of them were preserved. So they have loyalty to him. Also, Trudeau has complete control over kind of the party apparatus, too. You don't see, I mean, you see some of this fighting, some of this going on in Alberta right now. You see in the UCP, there's this Take Back Alberta faction that's fighting with. This is not happening here with the federal Liberals because, you know, they completely constructed it from the ground up. It was really Jerry Butts, originally Katie Telford, Trudeau, and they brought in Anna Ganey, who's the daughter of Bob Ganey, the NHL hockey player.
They were in the dumpster, and that team turned it all around.
They completely turned it around and then maintained control over the apparatus of the party, and that was Anna Ganey because she's married to Tom Pitfield, who is one of Trudeau's closest old friends. They grew up in Westmount together. Mm-hmm. And then he had, on sort of the governing side, he had Katie Telford, who had been with him throughout the leadership campaign and into government. You know, it's really kind of a two-headed act, this government. It's Trudeau and Telford, right? They run the show. That creates some frustrations within caucus. People grumble about that she has too much power. Why is the chief of staff showing up at caucus meetings? They don't like that. But that's the lay of the land, and I don't see anybody within the party being able to create kind of a coup from within the party structure.
And the point of going public with it is to, you know, would be hypothetically to kind of like create this chorus of pressure, go take a walk in the snow, your time is up, and go out with dignity as opposed to lose at this next election. All I'm hearing is he's never going to do that. Like, he is not of his own volition going to step down. Like, that's not going to happen.
He's not. He absolutely thinks he is the best person to beat Pierre Poilievre.
Do you think he can?
Yeah, sure, if the stars align. I mean, it's difficult. Trudeau's a really good campaigner, right? And this is the thing you got to remember about him. And he's a much more improved politician than he was back when he won the leadership. You know, remember like all the things, mistakes he made? He started beaking off about China being the country he admires and things like that. I mean, it was, you know, he was really undisciplined, wasn't smooth, and was, for a guy who had been a professional speaker through most of his career and made a lot of money doing that, he wasn't very good. He was not a good speaker. He's gotten a lot better at it.
It ended up kind of working for him because he made so many mistakes and he seemed so green and amateurish that when he showed up to the debate, I think the way Paul Wells put it, like, everyone was so surprised that he like had his pants on. Like, right. Everyone just expected him to just make an absolute ass of himself, and he wasn't good or anything, but it was just kind of like, oh, it was not terrible. And it almost created an interesting narrative. I think he could win. You know, I've given this free advice to his team before. I'm sure it's occurred to them independently, but I know how he could win.
Which is wow. I want to hear this.
He's just got to date a celebrity. I think that's what the separation was about. I think as opposed to the like, hey, honey, I know we've been estranged for a while, but please just for appearance to stick with me until this next election. I think it was the opposite. I think it was like, I can't get the American media coverage that I used to get in the next election. That's done. I'm not going to be on the cover of GQ. I don't know if it was purposeful or not. Who knows? But now he's in a position where I'm trying to think, like, who would it be? Like, she's got to be like maybe a couple years older than him, you know, maybe somebody who could be like has a certain whiff or patina of intellectualism or political engagement, but they never said anything controversial. Mm. Like Rashida Jones. Who should he date, Glenn?
Taylor Swift has shown remarkable impact on a person's career, judging by Travis Kelce's performance this year. But I don't think that couple's breaking up anytime soon. And then there would be kind of an age gap there that might seem a little bit unseemly. So
who's young Helen Mirren or you know what, if you really want to go for the headlines, Lena Dunham, you know, that was just try to compete with that, Pierre.
I don't know if that's necessarily on his radar. You know, I mean, that's, you know, the Trudeau marriage.
Now you're going to see. You're going to see. It's going to happen. Talk about. I'm placing my bet now. It's going to happen. Glenn, there's so much going on in the world right now that people are missing important news stories that they really should take note of. So we duly note them. Do you have a news story to duly note for our listeners?
The story I think is not getting enough attention right now is PharmaCare and the NDP demand in Ottawa to bring forward a piece of legislation implementing a national PharmaCare program by the end of the year. And they're saying if the Liberal government doesn't do that, their deal to support them, to sustain them in power until 2025 is off. It's big news. And it's also, you know, so it's a big political story, but it's also really important because it's essentially what the NDP is calling for is kind of a generational expansion of our public healthcare system to include prescription drugs, something we've just never done. That was originally the idea when Medicare was conceived in the 1960s. It just kind of never happened because it was always seen too expensive. Now it might happen if the Liberals go along with it. And it's going to be, I think it's going to be a campaign issue too, because Pierre Poilievre doesn't want to do it. The Bloc Québécois, probably they have their own system in Quebec that isn't working all that well. They might get on side. And it's also potentially, we talk about things that could save Justin Trudeau's bacon. This might be one of them. This could be a very popular program if he campaigns on essentially free or very low-cost prescription medication that covers all Canadians. The big discussion right now is whether or not the bill the Liberals come forward with is going to be something called a fill-the-gap system, so that just provides drug coverage to certain people who don't have it now through private plans or through other kind of provincial programs, or whether it's going to be a truly universal system, which the NDP is demanding. And they say, Jagmeet Singh has said this, if he doesn't get that, he's pulling the plug.
Imagine if Canadian news and Canadian politics actually revolved around discussion of things that matter to Canadians, like PharmaCare. Duly noted. I have one here. People may remember that the little, I don't know, I'm not going to call it a scandal, but like when we learned about how much money the government was paying to consultants and how much of the business of governing was being outsourced to these expensive consultants, there was a bit of a public uproar. And I want to duly note that the government is doing something about it. Here's a story that Bill Curry reported for the Globe and Mail. Ottawa paid nearly $670,000 for KPMG's advice on cutting consultant costs.
It's a wonderfully, deliciously ironic headline, isn't it?
Oh, mwah. Of course, that's a bargain, Glenn. I mean, I don't know how to cut consultant costs, so let's get a consultant on this.
Yeah, and it shows the reality of government in Ottawa is that government has so kind of lost the capacity to do anything themselves, they have to hire a consultant, even to address the issue of whether they should hire more consultants. I mean, that's the point they've reached.
Why don't we just elect consultants, KPMG, for Prime Minister?
Duly noted.
And that is Shortcuts for this week. Glenn, thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Jesse.
We're on Twitter at Canada Land. You can email me about what you heard today, jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything that you send. Where can people find you and what's your Substack called?
It's called A Few Tasteful Snaps. So Glenn McGregor, GlennMcGregor, .substack.com.
This episode is produced by Aviva Lessard with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our managing editor is Annette Ajofor. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Our theme music is by So-Called Syndications by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.